Welcome to In the Middle. I'm Joey Block. We have a jam-packed show for you, a lot to get to. Let's get right in the middle of it. Midterms are just days away, if you can believe it or not. We've been talking about it for months, and the day has finally come with Election Day coming this Tuesday. So if you haven't already, get out there and vote. And boy, things are getting tight and heated as we go into the final days of the campaign season. President Biden gave a speech on what he calls the threat to democracy Wednesday night. In a speech, he called the midterms a, quote, defining moment for Democrats, close quote. He said, quote, we must, with an overwhelming voice, stand against political violence and voter intimidation, period. Stand up and speak against it. We don't settle our differences in America with a riot, a mob, or a bullet, or a hammer. We settle them peacefully at the ballot box. We have to face this problem. We can't turn away from it. We can't pretend it's just going to solve itself. Close quote. In response, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell tweeted, quote, President Biden is desperate to change the subject from inflation, crime, and open borders. Now he's claiming that democracy only works if his party wins. What nonsense. Americans aren't buying it. Close quote. The speech was not all that well received even among members of his own party. Former Obama chief strategist David Axelrod tweeted, quote, issues of democracy are arguably important at this moment and in next week's elections. Totally appropriate for at POTUS to address them. Still, as a matter of practical politics, I doubt many D's in marginal races are eager for him to be on TV tonight. Close quote. The president gave the speech at Union Station, not far from the Capitol building, symbolizing what happened on January 6th. So a lot of breakdown here, obviously, because the fact is the president is doing this big speech just days before the midterm, and it was very unexpected. It was literally Wednesday during the day, we got word of, oh, the president's giving a big speech tonight on the threat of democracy, and everyone was like, well, what's that about? Like, why are we doing this now? What's the point? And that has raised a lot of significant questions here of what the game plan is and what the thought was behind it. But as the president pretty much has alluded to, this all has to do with the midterms. So the president is trying to switch gears here on the midterms. I mean, he's been going out campaigning for everybody, even though some people, quite frankly, don't want him on the campaign trail. But nevertheless, the president decided to butt in and insert himself there anyways. And Democrats are looking at the polls here, and the White House is too, saying, this ain't looking too good, because a lot of analysts are saying Republicans are going to pick up the House, and there's now a good chance that the Senate may also be in play. Because a lot of people are not happy with President Biden right now. I mean, if you just look at the polling, it's very lopsided. Depending on which poll you're looking at, it can be anywhere from the high 30s to low 40s. Which, if you recall, that's kind of around where former President Trump was during this time in his midterm season. And he lost over 40 seats there. So if that's the case, then Biden may be on a collision course for something similar. As it was, Republicans already did pretty well. They picked up a decent amount of House seats in 2020, considering that former President Trump lost that election, and that was considered by wide margins to be a Democratic year. But there still were some surprise stories there for Republicans down ballot. And if it's anything like that, we could be seeing some big gains here for the Republicans. And this could potentially be Biden trying to change the focus, change the narrative. Because Republicans have been dominating the issues of inflation, crime, and the border. Democrats have largely focused on January 6th, abortion, and to a lesser extent, gun violence. And gun violence kind of was there for like 5 seconds when the Uvalde thing was hot. But Democrats largely stayed away from that issue. And if you look down on the top concerns of voters, it's kind of low there. And that's why the gun violence thing. And January 6th, for a large part, and voter integrity, that's lower too. It's something that the Democratic base likes. So essentially, the president is trying to gin up the Democratic base here, because the reality is midterm elections these days are all based on base turnout. Unfortunately, it is not about the middle so much anymore, even though we talk about the middle on this show and the undecided voters. Yes, in these really tight races, they are going to make the difference. The middle, the undecided, the independents. But largely, it's really about base turnout, because the average person up until recently didn't really turn out for the midterms. Maybe. But for the most part, people do the presidential race and, well, that's it. And now in these partisan times, it's really about getting the base out there. So, especially if you're losing too, and you're not very popular. So, if you can't get your base out there, oh boy, you got a problem. Houston, we got a problem here. And that could be what Biden is looking at. Because Biden, let's be honest, he's a guy who's kind of, he's on the older side, so he's not really thrilled about change, so he likes to stick with the same message. But he might be seeing something, there's a problem here, I gotta fix something. But by fixing it, he's trying to change the subject. He's trying to now make it that his party is the only way democracy can be preserved. Now, if that's what he's seeing, then he's gotta go for it. But if Republicans want to galvanize on this, they're going to do exactly what Mitch McConnell was doing. If you're the Democrats, you really got to come up with a way to deal with the economic message here. And they kind of figured it out. Some of these swing Democrats have been talking about Social Security and Medicare, and that has largely worked for Democrats in midterm elections, talking about economic issues and just in general. I mean, look at FDR, JFK, all these guys were talking about it. And LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson, they were all talking about the social safety net. When you get into it, the Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, that is stuff that resonates with people. And also healthcare. Remember back to 2018, that was a winning issue for Democrats. A large part of why they took the House was because they ran on healthcare and how the Republicans really had no plan for Obamacare. So that's the type of message that Democrats are going to have to talk about and make it an economic issue. But so far, we have not seen that from the Democrats. So in these final days, can they really shift things around? Well, they got Obama, the big messenger out there. But where are they sending these Democratic politicians? You got to look close. You know where Kamala Harris, our vice president, and Hillary Clinton, our former first lady, was? Probably saying, oh, well, maybe Ohio, right? Maybe they see something there. Maybe Florida, right? Oh, well, those are probably Republicans. Oh, well, maybe it's more Georgia, right? Pennsylvania, something swing like that, right? No, that's not where they are at all. I'm telling you right now, that's not where they are. They went yesterday. Get ready for it. New York. Blue New York. Not a swing state. Not a red state. Not something they think they can flip. They're on defense in New York. That is not where you want to be days out from a campaign where all the media and all the pundits are saying you are not winning this thing. So they're out there trying to save Holcomb. So they're up in New York trying to save Holcomb while Republicans are looking to expand the map like you've never seen. So let's look at these results. We have to talk about them. Now, I could go through all this. I mentioned the New York race, how that's really tight. And I personally, if you want to know my political analysis here, there's three or four races I'm looking at to determine how the Republicans are going to do on election night and see where the margins are and determine what the wave will look like. That is that race, New York governor's race. Kathy Hochul, Democrat, versus Lee Zeldin. That's a race you got to watch. If Zeldin pulls it out, that could be an indicator where Republicans are going to do well across the country. It could make the difference between winning or losing. And also by the margin, too. And that's one of them. And then further on the ballot there, now you're probably saying, what are you talking about? There's nothing else. Yes, there is. There's a race that no one's talking about that may even be more shocking. And that is the Attorney General's race in New York between Letitia James and Michael Henry. Michael Henry, there is a poll by Trafalgar, which is a Republican pollster, but it was one of the few polls that correctly predicted Donald Trump's victory, has him up by 1 point. Now, this has been a very poorly polled race, but if he won that, Zeldin won New York, and it was by, I'd say, significant margins, you know, 5 points, maybe more. That could be downstream to what we see all over the country and in other parts of the Northeast. Because then you got to go over to Rhode Island, CD2. There, Rhode Island, I said it, Rhode Island, this is a place, they do not vote for Republicans. They have not put a Republican in federal office in decades. And they may just do it on Tuesday night. So we have to look at that. And the polling for that race, it has gone to 8 or 9 points in some cases. Now, will it actually be that? That's the question. If it is 8 or 9 points, then that could key in on where Republicans are going to go here and whether they're going to have a good night or not. Then you got to look at Connecticut, CD5. That's kind of a swing district too. Also something that went for Biden big time. And Republicans, they think they got a decent shot there. So if all four of those races, if they go Republican and they're by significant margins, let's look at the key Senate races. Because ultimately, the Senate... Yeah, everyone talks about Florida, Arizona, Ohio. There's only a very few that are actually going to determine this thing that are considered toss-ups by a lot of political analysts out there. Now, Florida and Ohio, the traditional, Republicans look like they're going to take that. So we're not going to really dive into that or North Carolina. But we are going to go into a few here. Now, it depends. Some people have already projected this or have rated this lean red or lean blue or whatever. But these are what would be the toss-up races that essentially both parties are going to need in order to take control of the Senate. And the Senate really is the big prize because the House, it's really only 5 seats you got to pick up. And with hundreds of House seats, it's very easy to do, as I've told you. There's many paths. And you could run through right here in New Jersey if you really wanted to. If they had a clean sweep there, that would put them in a good position. Now, I'm not saying that's not going to happen. We're going to talk about New Jersey races, too, but let's focus on the Senate. So, obviously, we got to talk about Pennsylvania. That's the big prize here because without Pennsylvania, it's very difficult for either party to have control of the Senate. It really runs through Pennsylvania. And the Real Clear Politics average, this race has been getting really hot and really tight. Dr. Mehmet Oz, get ready for it. I want you to listen very closely to these numbers. 46.6% to Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman's, ready, 46.3. So we're talking about 0.3 percentage points between the two of them, according to Real Clear Politics average. That's insane. That's really tight. If that goes down, we may not know this election result for days, if not weeks. We've already heard that from the Pennsylvania Secretary of State this week, that we may not have that result on election night. And this may be why. And if you recall, John Fetterman was running the table largely for most of this race, double-digit leads. But due to that debate performance, now, we've heard some conflicting information of whether that was a factor in people's decisions. Some polls say yes, some say no. But the reality is Dr. Oz did start to gain momentum after the debate performance where Fetterman, it was pretty obvious he had to use closed captioning. He kind of couldn't really answer his flip-flopping on fracking. And Dr. Oz, he had some scrutiny on his performance too, but Fetterman largely struggled in that debate to articulate his positions. And some people said that, you know, you were mocking the disabled and you really couldn't talk about that. But the reality is there are, it seems to be that there are some Pennsylvania voters are concerned, and that may be the difference in this race. As it was somewhat tightening before that debate. It could be a red wave phenomena, but nonetheless, Pennsylvania is tight. So that is the race to watch on election night. Now, I mentioned my indicator races. Those are indicators. In terms of who's taking the Senate, this is it. Because if Republicans stop it right here, they maintain the seat. Because right now, it's Republican Pat Toomey who has a seat, but he's retiring. So if Pat Toomey has his seat taken by Dr. Oz, if Dr. Oz keeps that in the Republican column, then that makes it very hard for Democrats to maintain control. That makes it extremely difficult because they would then have to hold on to Nevada, hold on to Arizona, hold on to Georgia, and have to pick it up somewhere. And that would be a real question of where they could pick up. They would have to go to an Ohio, a North Carolina, or a Florida. Or they'd have to go out to Wisconsin with Ron Johnson, which Ron Johnson looks like he's going to win that one. Based on the polling out there, he's up right now, and especially in the Real Clear Politics average. So they would have to go to one of those states potentially to make up the difference. So if Democrats don't win Pennsylvania, and even though the polls are closing a little earlier than the other races we're going to be talking about, we may not know this one. This may not be, you might have to go to bed and wake up the next morning and check your phones, check the TV, and see where Pennsylvania's going. Now we have to go down south to the next one, and that would be the Georgia Senate race. Real Clear Politics average there. This puts football player Herschel Walker at 47.1% to, you gotta listen to these numbers closely too, the incumbent Senator Raphael Warnock's 46.6%. So that's 0.5. So half a percentage point is in Walker's direction. And that's a turnaround because Raphael Warnock has been running the table on this for a large part of this race. This is kind of a trend similar to Pennsylvania, but there's also been controversies surrounding that race as well, which we've discussed on the show with Herschel Walker's allegations that he paid for women to have abortions. And that's kind of contrary with his current stance where he wants a national abortion ban with no exceptions. So it's put him in some hot water, but a lot of the polling has suggests that voters really aren't paying attention to this. And because based on the polling that we've seen from down there, inflation seems to be the top issue. So if that's the case, and inflation, if you've gone to the grocery store at the gas pump recently, it ain't not a pretty picture. So that puts Walker in a good position there. But here is, we got to throw a wrench in this whole thing. In Georgia, as you may recall from the Senate race last year, they tend to do runoffs there. Basically, if neither candidate gets 50% or more in the initial tally, that race has to go to a runoff where the top two people, which would be the two of them, obviously, the third party candidates would be all eliminated. They would have to go again for a runoff on December 6th, get everybody out back out there to vote for them again and to determine who the actual winner would be. And naturally, a lot of people are saying the national environment right now is good for Republicans. Either Herschel Walker can pull it out regardless. But as we know, a month is a lifetime in politics. Anything can happen. Democrats may throw a lot of money at this thing. Biden might say, we need a course correction. They might try anything. And like I told you, if the Democrats lose Pennsylvania, then Georgia, they're really going to put a lot of money down on this. Okay. They're going to have to, if it goes to runoff, they're really going to have to try and save Raphael Warnock. And they put a lot of money in the race last time. You saw Biden go down there back in 2020, 2021. So very clear possibility they could do the same thing again. But what is working in Walker's favor is Brian Kemp, who's a Republican governor running for re-election, he's doing quite well against Stacey Abrams. That's a rematch from 2018 where he narrowly won. Now he's winning by a larger margin, and that race looks like it's not going to runoff territory. It looks like he'll probably win around 51% of the vote based on the polling. So he might carry Herschel Walker over, but that could be a race we're still talking about for weeks and weeks on end. So that's a race to watch. That's one of the toss-ups to go either way. Now you go out to Arizona. This is a race we're not going to know probably till 11 o'clock midnight where it's heading. If that, this is an interesting race because a lot of the top concerns out there are inflation and border because it is a border state. And there's been a massive influx of migrants at the southern border. There's been drug problems with fentanyl. And a lot of people are saying that's going to favor the Republicans. And let's go through the Real Clear Politics average on that one. The Real Clear Politics average puts Senator Mark Kelly with 48.4% over Blake Masters, who is at 46.4%. So an exact 2% difference there. Oh, Blake Masters is a large man struggling venture capitalist endorsed by Trump. He's really the guy that Trump wants to be there. And a lot of people are wondering whether that was a good choice or not. They say he's a weak candidate. You know, he's still getting on his feet there. And they would have rather had Mark Brnovich, who is the Arizona Attorney General, as the Republican candidate in this race. So there could be some buyer's remorse on the Republican establishment side, and the criticism that he hasn't gotten a lot of money in his campaign, and that Mark Kelly is somewhat liked. But then the Democrats are worried because he's not a big personality, Mark Kelly. So a lot of people don't know, although, yeah, he's got the astronaut thing going. He largely won on a wave. And also, as you recall, Cindy McCain endorsed Joe Biden in 2020, which, as you know, not a lot of split ticket situations going on there. People don't split their tickets anymore. You're not seeing people vote for Democrat one office, Republican the other. So there was a whole blue wave that hit Arizona in 2020. But this year, people are wondering whether Republicans, this may be their year because of border security, because of inflation. There's a lot of high gas prices going on in Arizona. And you have to think about the dynamics too. And unfortunately, they are all connected, these races. You have to go to the governor's race with Carrie Lake. She is beloved by conservatives right now. They're talking about 2024 with her already, whether she's going to be Trump's running mate if he runs. So she's ahead. And a lot of the pundits out there say she's going to win. So the question is whether she can drag Blake Masters over the finish line with her. Because right now, she's doing pretty well. And this is a traditionally Republican state. This is not like a Michigan or Wisconsin where it was a blip and then it went back to Biden. This is something that Republicans should be able to win no problem. And we've been seeing some motion towards the Democrats for the last 4 years now. 2018 with Kyrsten Sinema winning the Senate race there. Then in 2020 with Biden winning and Mark Kelly winning, the governor's race was really only the statewide contest that the Republicans were still pretty good on. But they might be able to flip the script here in a Republican year. And that's the question. A lot of people, there's a lot of projections out there saying Blake Masters is going to take him. And that the polling's just wrong in this. That we have a 2016 effect going on here. The pollsters just aren't getting to the Republicans. So that's a race we're going to have to watch too. Because if Republicans want to win the Senate, they're going to have to go back to the traditional Republican states while also gaining its new territory or semi-new territory. And that's where it brings to the next race, Nevada. Nevada used to vote Republican all the time. But then once we started seeing more diverse populations settle out there, that kind of moved away from the GOP. And GOP operatives are starting to get worried there. But now, they're starting to see some favorable ratings out there that is going to swing it back into their direction. And the Real Clear Politics average for that one, they have the Republican candidate Adam Laxalt at 47% to Senator, who's the incumbent Democrat out there, Catherine Cortez Masto, at a little more than 45%. So it's around a 2% margin there in Adam Laxalt's favor. Now, why is that? Nevada, it has not gone red in a while. Now, they did have Dean Heller, that senator, but he lost in 2018. But it may end up being a good night for Republicans in Nevada because there's some congressional seats out there they're looking at too. And also, Trump did perform pretty well in Nevada. Back when we saw that Michigan and Wisconsin weren't looking good, people wanted, if he wins Nevada and Pennsylvania, he might be able to pull this thing out. And ultimately didn't, but it was single digits there. So now the question comes, can Republicans do it? And Adam Laxalt looks good. Then you got Joe Lombardo, who's on the governor's side and the Republicans, he's ahead. So there's a good chance that Republicans do well there. And because inflation is a big concern and gas prices are higher than the national average in Nevada. These are the energy states. That New Mexico, which Republicans are a little optimistic about for the governor's race there too, that this energy message of American energy independence and that we need to pump more oil there, they're saying that this may be a good issue for them. Now, let's talk about the surprise here. And the surprise is the New Hampshire Senate race. A lot of people, you know, they had it on the radar, but they really weren't really keen on it. But now we're looking at it and saying, maybe there's something there. Now, let's look at the Real Clear Politics average here. Retired Army General Don Bolduc is at 47.3%. to incumbent Democrat Senator there, Maggie Hassan, with 47. So he just narrowly taken the lead. Now, this is as of Thursday, but right now he is taking the lead there with 3%, 0.3% of the vote, which if you look at it, that is quite astonishing considering he was down repeatedly up until very recently where we started to get some new polling, what's going on the ground. And this is a guy a lot of people saw as a flawed candidate because he has insisted Trump was the duly elected president in 2020, that Biden is illegitimate. Then he started to kind of backpedal on that, started to moderate. And that's when we saw the changes start to happen and the changes on the ground too, because again, Northeast states, you know, the winter costs are expected to be high. Heating costs are a big issue up there. And let me tell you, New Hampshire, it gets cold up there. And they're looking at their energy bill saying, what the hell is this? They might just say, you know what, listen, this guy's a little crazy, but this Maggie Hassan woman, I don't know if she's going to do it for me. I need my prices down. I'm pulling it for Don Bolduc. Also, you got Chris Sununu, governor up there, very popular Republican governor, who is pushing for Bolduc now. So that could also be a reason why Bolduc is doing well, because people are coming home. So we're going to have to see if Republicans can pull out New Hampshire. If they could, that's a good night. That's going to be a signal of a good night. And like I said, if we look at my four key races in the Northeast, that could also indicate where New Hampshire goes. And if New Hampshire goes well, those four races are probably going to go well for the Republicans. And it could go all downstream from there. And the Democrats could be looking themselves silly, what in God's name is going on? And it could affect the races in New Jersey. Now, let's look at some of the congressional races here in New Jersey. We got to talk about the 7th Congressional District, right? Between Congressman Tom Malinowski and former Senate Minority Leader Tom Kaine Jr. Now, this race, the most recent internal poll we've gotten from Malinowski's team, which was done by Greenberg Quinlan Rozier, I believe is how you say that. The internal poll has them dead even, 48% each. And this was done back in July. So we really don't have the most on-the-ground numbers that we should have. But from this poll, we do have some indicators of where this is heading. Now, if you look at the Malinowski approval rating, he's only got 44% and 34% disapprove. That means most people in this district don't really have a clue of who he is, or they don't like him. That's not what you want to have going into this. Now, those numbers can turn around, but there's been a lot of attack ads. The GOP has spent a lot of cash in this district. Tom Kaine is endorsed by practically every congressional leader you can find who has an R next to their name. He's got a lot riding on it, although he has hidden from the media a lot. He refused to talk to the Star-Ledger. They overwhelmingly endorsed Tom Malinowski. They wrote a terrible, terrible review of Tom Kaine. And the Republicans have really bashed the Star-Ledger in general for the way they've endorsed candidates. Does that resonate? Well, also, this district has been drawn to be more Republican, so that's going in his favor. He also has the last name of a very popular former governor in New Jersey. So that may be enough to push him over the edge. Also, and this is something Tom Kaine has been talking about, Biden. Biden and Malinowski's approval ratings are practically identical. They both got 44% on the positive. On the negative, Biden's even worse. 54% disapprove in this district. That's what the residents of this district think of our president. If that's the case, if people are just so pissed off at Biden, they're just like, you know what? Tom Malinowski, your blue check mark on President Biden. We do not want the check mark. We want a check, as in a check in ourselves. Then Tom Kaine could potentially do very well there. That leads us to a surprise district. Well, it's not so much a surprise. It was kind of on the radar, but people have written it off. But in recent weeks and days, the 3rd Congressional District in New Jersey is really getting a lot of attention. And that is between incumbent Democratic Congressman Andy Kim and yacht company executive Bob Healy. This is very interesting. And overall in New Jersey, we really haven't gotten a lot of polling, which makes this very hard to track. But like I said, if we get all these good numbers everywhere else in the Northeast, New Jersey's probably going to have a downstream effect. That means 7th District is going to do well, and 3rd District could probably go well for the GOP as well. Let's look at this, because this poll is from July, but it's kind of an interesting poll. This is, again, RMG Research. They did the poll, and it had Kim at 44% and Healy at 38%. So 6-point margin. That's actually not really bad considering the way this district is drawn, because Biden won this district because, you know, they redrew the district since 2020, but they did the math on it. He would have won it by 14 points. So clearly Healy's making some ground here with the Biden folks. And Biden has a approval rating even slightly worse than the 7th, 43% and 55 disapprove. With that kind of margin, because Healy's already been talking about inflation, crime, how we can't have someone who's voting with Biden all the time. He's been putting it out in the final days. He's been putting his own personal money in, and his mom's super PAC also got involved. And this guy has been funding his way through this despite not getting a lot of national money that we thought we'd be getting in this race. But again, Andy Kim has beat the odds. Donald Trump won his old district before they redrew the whole thing by 0.2%, and then Kim won it by close to 5 points. So he knows how to win these type of races that are tight. But again, if it's a wave election, that could mean Healy's got it. And the Cook Political Report, just when you thought, I don't know, they moved this from likely Democratic to lean Democratic. So that means there's a pickup opportunity in a wave, a red wave election. The likely Dem seats are questionable. Lean DM, that means the Republicans are almost bound to win when it gets to that rating. Now we have to go up to the 11th Congressional District, Mikey Sherrill versus Paul DeGroote. I interviewed both of them on this show, so we have a little personal insight there of where this is heading. But we don't have a lot of polling, or any that we have, any publicly available polling. Now the campaigns probably have it, but they have not shared like the other two races that we have seen. The money is what is the money race here is why this may not be a good night for Paul DeGroote. But again, if it's a wave, Paul DeGroote may get some of the wave and he might be able to pull this one out. Now, Mike Bloomberg put some money in this race. A PAC associated with him gave Sherrill $2 million last week. So you could argue either they're like, yeah, she's got a good shot, let me give her some more money, or they're like, oh crap, we need to give her more money. So with that in mind, Bloomberg's giving her the money. And despite that, Cheryl has $3 million on hand, according to her last financial disclosure form, and has raised around $6 million since this campaign started. And it might be more, to be honest with you. It's hard to find a straight number on that. But Cheryl's got money, and money is important in a local race. However, sometimes the grassroots is enough to pull people up to success. I mean, Paul DeGroote pulled an upset. He was not supposed to win this race. He only had one county organizational line, and his competitor, who is the front runner for the Republican nomination, essentially, for this, DeGroote beat him with less money than this guy had. So in that case, DeGroote might be able to come against the odds. You know, he's a former prosecutor. He talks about crime. That's a centerpiece. He has bashed Cheryl on the stock trades issue, where she forgot to disclose a certain number of stock trades that she did. And that could be a winning issue. And Cheryl has largely hit Paul DeGroote on his abortion stance, basically saying that he wants to take abortion away. DeGroote has said, no, that's not the case. I am pro-choice. This is a state's issue. And we'll have to see where that goes from there. But important thing to know about DeGroote's funding, and that could be a problem for him, he only has $278,996 on hand, according to the last filing with the FEC, and has raised $636,823 that we could find. And Biden also won this by 17 points. So he's got some obstacles. But again, you've been noticing GOP has been putting money in recently to these districts that were once considered unwinnable. And he's a part of the Young Guns program with the Republican congressional arm. So they got their eye on him. And then finally, we got the 5th congressional district, which is Josh Gottheimer, Democratic congressman there, and Frank Pallotta, who, this is a rematch. He ran in 2020, but he didn't put as much money in this time as he did last time. He put in over $1 million of his own money. Now, he only has $171,145,000 on hand. That's all he's got. He's only got a little under $200,000 in the bank. And has raised, the entire time he's been running this campaign, $665,091. Now let's talk about Gottheimer. Gottheimer has $14 million on hand. That's on hand. That's not what he's risen. That's just what he has on hand. And on top of that, Mike Bloomberg also gave him some money. In addition to Cheryl, he also threw some money at Gottheimer. $2.3 million from a Bloomberg affiliate group. Now, there has been some concern. The Democrats have been throwing money at Gottheimer because they were worried whether he could hold on to this. There was less worry than there was worry. Now they're a little worried. Now you have to wonder, will the money be enough to go against the red wave? Now, Biden, he would have gotten in this district, and we have a Biden versus Trump scenario, Biden would have gotten around 56 percentage points to Trump's 43. So this is definitely Biden territory, without question. Also, redistricting is more favorable to Gottheimer in this regard. And Pallotta is a part of the Young Guns program, just like Paul DeGroote is. And he's on their radar. And the interesting thing is, recently he's gotten some pretty high-profile endorsements. He's gotten Newt Gingrich to endorse him, former Speaker of the House. So will those people be enough to get some money? Because regardless, these people should be able to generate some money in there for Pallotta. But we really have not seen it. And Pallotta has not put the same amount of money in as previously done. So we're going to have to see. But we have to go down to the 6th district now. And that is where we find incumbent Democratic Congressman Frank Pallone. He's going up against Monmouth County Commissioner Sue Kiley. Well, joining me now is incumbent Democratic Congressman from New Jersey's 6th Congressional District, Frank Pallone. Congressman Pallone, thanks so much for joining me.
Of course.
You're currently running for another term in Congress. Why are you running for re-election?
Well, I think that I get things done, and I'm proud of my record and what I've accomplished, and particularly in the last 2 years, Congress and a lot of the bills that have passed are, came out of my committee. So, I talk about the major three bills, which are the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which has been funding all kinds of infrastructure projects like Gateway, for example, but also things like cleaning up Superfund sites and providing funding for to replace lead pipes. And a lot of those come out of the Energy and Commerce Committee that I chair. And then the second bill was the Chips and Science Act, which tries to address the supply chain. In other words, we know during COVID that the supply chain was broken. Whether you were trying to get parts for cars or ventilators, a lot of that was coming from overseas, China, other countries, and it wasn't available. So we want to bring back domestic manufacturing, starting with the semiconductors or the chips, and that a lot of that came out of our committee. And then the last thing was maybe the most important was the Inflation Reduction Act, and the health and environmental provisions of that came out of our committee. So the two health things I talk about a lot are the negotiated prices for prescription drugs under Medicare to try to bring the cost of prescription drugs down, and then the expansion of subsidies and tax credits for the Affordable Care Act, so that people can have afford health insurance. The majority of the people that first of all, we're up to like 95% of the Americans have health insurance now. And a lot of that has to do with making health insurance more affordable through the Affordable Care Act. But I mean, I'll go on. You have other questions. I mean, I'm not going to go on, Joe. You have other questions.
Well, I appreciate that, Congressman. And yes, I do. And we're going to definitely touch more about the Inflation Reduction Act for sure, since it's a big piece of legislation for sure. But I want to get into the aspect of campaigning, since you're out there doing it, you're in the final stretches of it. And some people are worried about when they're going out on the campaign trail now, since there's been a string of political violence recently, with the most prominent example being the attack on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home. Now, as you campaign for re-election, you're on the trail. Do you feel safe campaigning?
Well, I have a tendency to not pay attention to my own safety, which is probably not good, but I do have that tendency. I don't know why, but that's kind of me, and so I don't think about it much. But I will say in the larger context that, I do think that the biggest problem here is that the Republicans are just trying to villainize, maybe that's the word, make villains out of all the Democrats. And, it's all this negativity. I mean, I really feel the Democrats want to do things to help people. And most of what I already discussed with you was in that vein, trying to make things more affordable, trying to do things to help people, improve the country. And I just see the Republicans all concentrating on this effort to make Democrats villains. And so I think a consequence of that, of course, is someone attacks the speaker. I mean, she's been more villainized than anybody, and it's just terrible. But personally, I don't think much about it. That may be good or bad, but I don't.
Now, some of your colleagues have called on Congress to put aside funds for their security as we head into the final days of the campaign. Right now, it's mainly leadership who gets the big security details and all the bells and whistles, not so much the run-of-the-mill members of Congress. Should all members of Congress be having a security detail with them in this heightened political environment?
Well, I think they should if they feel they need it, right? In other words, yes, it should be available to all members, because we've had these incidents with, where members have been attacked regardless of whether they were in leadership or not. So we had, the situation that time with Gabby Giffords, which is a few years ago. We had Steve Scalise at the baseball game. If members, it should be available, right? Whereas now it's not. In other words, I mean, unless you can absolutely show that you're under attack, then they'll help you. But generally speaking, none of us get any kind of security. So yeah, I mean, the answer is yes. Some people may not decide that they need it, but generally it should be available, I think.
I want to talk about the president. President Biden isn't very popular right now, including among some members of your own party. Do you still consider yourself a Biden supporter?
Absolutely. And I just, you know, I don't quite understand why he, you know, why he his favorability, I guess, is not as high as I think it should be, because everything that I talked to you about, of course, was passed, you know, the three bills I mentioned to you, and there are more, were all passed by a Democratic Congress, but he signed them and he supported them all. And I do think that, you know, he's like the Democrats in the majority in the House and the Senate are trying to get things done and help people. And because the Republicans just villainize everybody, he becomes a villain too. And I really don't understand the phenomenon.
Now, the president says he intends to run again in 2024, but he still hasn't made a final decision on that. Some people are saying he should just hang it up and let someone else take the reins here. If he goes through with a 2024 run, does he have your support?
Absolutely.
Now, I want to shift gears here and get to something in more of your expertise. The nation is currently suffering from a diesel shortage, with experts saying we only have about 25-day supply, which is different from our usual, where it's between 35 and 40 days, causing the price to go up. Now, you're the chairman of the House and Energy and Commerce Committee. What's the solution to the shortage?
Well, the problem with gas prices, and, you know, whether it's diesel, whatever, and you heard the president talk about it a couple of days ago, or maybe it was even yesterday, is the lack of production. In other words, the oil companies are not producing. And we had a hearing, I think it was last spring, where we dragged them in. And at that point, and I don't think it's changed much, production was less than it was before COVID, right? So, and now you have OPEC, you know, cutting back on production. So, you know, the president was, I don't know, it was yesterday or a couple of days ago, he said, look, if they don't increase production, we're going to do a windfall profits tax. I mean, every day in the Wall Street Journal, I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating, but at least in the last week, I'm sure two or three times where major companies had reported their quarterly earnings and they were through the roof, their quarterly profits, I should say, and they were through the roof. And of course, OPEC, you know, same thing. They just want to make all this money, give it money back to the shareholders and make us suffer. And of course, that's all compounded by the war in Ukraine, okay, which is, you know, a major factor in all of this. And, you know, so we're doing certain things. I mean, the president has been releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is one of the things that I support. In fact, we introduced a bill called the Buy Low, Sell High Act that essentially sets up a separate petroleum reserve just for to deal with the price issue. You know, we've been our committee, and that, you know, that's in our committee, and then our committee passed and the House passed a bill that goes after gouging by the oil companies, price gouging, but the Senate hasn't taken, you know, we don't have the 60 votes in the Senate. So a lot of this just deals with production, and it's purposeful on the part of the, you know, whether it's diesel, it's gas, whatever, home energy, it's all the fact that they're trying to make a greater profit and succeeding in doing so. So I don't know what else to tell you, Joey.
Now, as you mentioned, gas prices going up, that's a general trend we've seen across the country, whether it's regular or diesel fuel. You're blaming the oil companies for the high prices. Some experts disagree with you, saying that it just has to do with the marketplace rather than any individual company. If the government took action against the big oil companies, how would this bring down gas prices?
Well, I'm not, look, a big part of it, as I mentioned, remember, it is an international phenomenon, right? So the biggest problem is the war in Ukraine. In other words, because of the fact that Western European or our allied countries in NATO, for the most part, are trying to either, they're either not buying or they're trying to wean themselves off Russian gas, you know, the price is higher, and that affects the international price, right? But we could certainly do things like, you know, as I mentioned, we talk about the SPRO, talk about trying to, you know, if the Senate could go pass this Consumer Fuel Price Gouging Act. But I mean, essentially, the oil companies are sitting on something, and this all came up at our hearing when we asked the oil companies to increase production, and they're sitting on about 9,000 unused drilling permits, which, if they were, you know, and these are permits that have been approved, they can pump, right? If they did that, then it would, gas prices would come down. They're artificially high, in my opinion. Yes, it's it's a function of the war and the international price in OPEC, but also they're not doing anything here at home to make a difference, which I think if they were increasing production and you know, pumping with some of those permits they already have, it would make a difference, in my opinion.
You mentioned the increase in production. Republicans, along with some other members of your party, are calling for American energy independence. And the GOP has used this term to mean America should increase its domestic oil production. And you kind of mentioned it right here, where if they have pumped more oil in America, then maybe these prices would start to go down. So in light of that, is it time to go back to that American energy independence model that we were kind of doing before COVID, rather than, because right now you have a lot of people saying, oh, we need to go more towards clean energy, but can we go solely to clean energy and not pay attention to the fossil fuels?
No, you can't solely go to clean energy. You have to have increased production. And I do blame the oil companies for holding back on production. Remember, when we had this hearing back in the spring, it takes about 6 months to really increase production. So if they had started doing that then, by now you would see significant increase in production. And there has been some increase because of the president's pressure, but it hasn't been enough. But I mean, look, I'm not saying, I mean, ultimately you do have to move towards clean energy, first of all, because of the impact on the climate of increased use of fossil fuels. And in the Inflation Reduction Act, I didn't mention that, you know, it was the first comprehensive effort to address climate change and encourage renewables, which again came out of our committee. But you know, there's several reasons, not only climate change, but also the fact that we're relying on these countries that are, for the most part, either our enemies or volatile domestic systems. And what are we talking about here? Russia, Saudi Arabia, the Arabian, these are dictatorships, volatile places like Venezuela, Nigeria. I mean, it's we can't continue to rely on this market of fossil fuels that is so volatile, and the majority of which, or a good part of which, is within produced by countries that are sworn enemies of the United States, or at least not friendly enough. So you have to do both. I mean, right now you have to increase production to bring the price down, and all the other things that I mentioned, you know, the SPRO. But ultimately, and while we're increasing production, we still have to move towards clean energy for all the reasons.
Now, you mentioned the Inflation Reduction Act. You've advocated for it, obviously, saying it will lower the cost of living for New Jersey residents. But the Congressional Budget Office claims that it doesn't actually ease inflation. And your opponent, Monmouth County Commissioner Sue Kiley, said on this show, the law won't reduce drug prices until 2025. So for people who are out there wondering, how is this going to make my life easier right now? What's in this bill that will reduce inflation for New Jerseyans right now?
Well, I mean, it is partially things that will happen soon and other things that will happen long term. So, you know, I want you to understand that the reason that it's labeled the Inflation Reduction Act is because it reduces the debt. In other words, reduces the deficit, I should say. In other words, it reduces the deficit by over $1 trillion over the lifetime of the bill. And so that is something that will help reduce inflation. But in the more, you know, in the more immediate term, every one of these things that I mentioned starts now and unfolds more and more as time goes on. So let's use the prescription drug benefit, right? So it's not only negotiated prices, but it's also out-of-pocket costs. So beginning in January, there's a $2,000 cap on how much seniors would pay out-of-pocket. is a cap on insulin of $35 a month. There's a provision that says that, which also begins the first, that says that you can't increase drug prices more than the rate of inflation. Otherwise, you have to rebate the difference to the federal government. And then gradually over the next few years, we take drugs, you know, that are patented. Remember, this only deals with patented drugs, right? For which there's a monopoly because it's patented. And it takes the ones that have the highest price and so many per year over the next 10 years, I believe. And well, actually for the lifetime of it. And then negotiates those prices to bring the cost down, which I think will not only have impact on Medicare, but also on the cost of drugs in the commercial market. Because I believe that if the government negotiates the price down, I don't think insurance companies are going to pay more than that, even in the commercial sector. So, you know, see, I use that as an example, but we can use an example for other things as well with regard to the Affordable Care Act, right? The people that buy their insurance through the marketplace, or Obamacare, some people call it. Those subsidies will continue for the next 3 years. They're already in effect now, and they bring down the cost for the average person who's in the Obamacare marketplace to less than $100 a month to buy their insurance. I mean, I'm just talking about the healthcare, but we can talk about some of the other things too if you want.
I want to specifically talk about something you've advocated for throughout your time in Congress, and specifically when trying to get in this bill, and that would be the state and local tax deduction. You've repeatedly said on major spending proposals, including this one and Build Back Better, no salt, no deal. But despite that, and all these multiple attempts of getting it in these spending bills, all those efforts were ultimately unsuccessful. So why should voters trust you with another term of getting their salt deduction back?
Well, all of this is the fault of the Republicans, right? So, in other words, the tax bill that they passed under President Trump reduced, before that tax bill, which is a few years ago now, but when Trump was president, and the Republicans were in control of Congress, they passed the tax bill that instead of being able to deduct all of your, you know, property taxes, state income tax, whatever, they limited it to capped it at $10,000. They did that. We voted no, including myself, right? Then in the Build Back Better Act, remember I don't want to be too much of a bureaucrat, but the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, is the Senate name for the Build Back Better Act. They took the Build Back Better Act and amended it, and then they change the name, but it's the same bill. It's just eliminate a lot of things, including the salt reduction. So in the Build Back Better Act, which passed totally partisan, no Republican voted for it, we brought back the salt deduction fully, so it was no longer capped at 10. They all voted against it. And then in the Senate, we couldn't get the majority. And so, it ended up coming out. So the reason this is 10,000 instead of unlimited is because of the Republicans. The reason that it's not in the Inflation Reduction Act is because of the Republicans. And then they say, oh, it's the Democrats. Well, you know, that's like a total lie. I don't know how else to describe it. And if they were in the majority, none of these things would even come up because the Republican leadership is totally opposed to fixing the salt. They say that this is just a phenomena of the, you know, Northeast, a handful of states like New Jersey, New York, California. They're never going to post that. So the only chance you have is having a Democratic majority that will continue to push to bring all the salt back. So, I mean, that's the most absurd thing of all, Joey, to suggest that somehow we're responsible for that. I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
Well, we'll have to see if Democrats maintain control of one or both chambers in a matter of days. Unfortunately, I've run out of time. New Jersey's 6th District Democratic Congressman Frank Pallone, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Joey. You take care. Keep in touch.
Well, that about wraps it up for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me as always. We'll be back in next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.